I'm still Susan. So I have a panelist of Essanons, and it's Amy, Crystal, and Kathleen. And they will also introduce themselves and tell you where they're at, where they're from. I'll leave that to them.
And our panelists on the SA side, geographically, from north to south, Vaughn W. from Surrey, BC, Ish W. from Seattle, and Mike D. from Battleground, Washington.
You guys might have to hold the mics because I don't think they're going to pick you up from this far away.
Here,
yeah.
I'll hold it
for
my camera.
You're the higher horsepower guy.
We'll let them begin.
Yeah, would you ladies like to start?
Thank you. We've been asked if we'd start. So there are two questions that came in for the Essanons, and it has to do with disclosure, and I think we'll tackle that first. One question says, what are some of the most damaging and unhelpful aspects for an Essanon receiving disclosure that sponsors might help their SA newcomer avoid? So what might you not do? And what would we recommend with that? I'll read the other disclosure, the other question in a second. Can you hear me? Okay, good. Lift it up. How's that? Is that better? Okay. Thank you. All right, so unhelpful ways to receive disclosure. I think the biggest thing is whether or not the Essanon has a support system, either a therapist or is in a Essanon meeting where they are receiving, they know that they have someone that they can talk to. I have had sponsees say, I'm going to be getting a disclosure, and I say, okay, let's bookend that disclosure. That means I want to talk to you before it happens, and maybe I'll even meet with you after it happens. And so that person feels they have a safe place that they can talk and be with. That doesn't have to be a sponsor. It can be but it's someone in that person's ballpark to help them. I would say another unhelpful aspect that happened for me was because I thought I had to know it all right away, I said, tell me everything. That is not a good idea. was not a good idea for me. My husband told me pretty much everything, and I wasn't suicidal, but I was pretty depressed and upset, and I did not have a support system at that time. So, all that being said, I will say that over the years, I've heard Essanons who've said, well, I got a little bit of disclosure, then I got a little bit more, then I got a little bit more, then I got a little bit more. Mm. That was also not really helpful. And I understand that sometimes we bury things we don't want to remember. And so it may not have been purposeful, but it is actually more harmful to the individual just getting it in little doses. So not all at once and not dribbled out over years. Somewhere in the middle there, hopefully you can find a healthy balance of disclosure.
You don't have to.
I'll comment on every question?
If you want to. But we've got a limited amount of time, too, whatever.
Yeah, that one I think I'll pass on. Okay. I might talk about the other disclosure.
Okay,
one.
So yeah. I'll just move ahead to the other disclosure question. How do we go about a full disclosure? What to include and what to leave out? And when in recovery do you share so that it is the most beneficial and avoid unnecessary hurt? I'm going to say, and I think I'm glad they added the phrase unnecessary hurt. This is a painful process. It is a painful process. And I, as an Essanon, was really good at stuffing my feelings. So I wasn't even able to access what I was feeling. I oftentimes would say to my husband, okay, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I'll get back to you when I figure it out. And it might take a week. I didn't know what I was feeling. He kept expecting this huge explosion. And I know I did take a watermelon and smash it on the floor. I do remember that. But other than that, my anger was very, came out sideways towards myself and other people. So, you know, do we need full disclosure? And how does that full disclosure look? I think, personally, I needed to know, you know, early in recovery, I thought I needed to know everything. In time, I realized I did not need to know details of every encounter and every place. I wanted to know the name of the last act-out partner. If I had known the name, I would have possibly gone to confront this person. I'm really glad now that I still do not know what this person looks like or who she is. So, you know, we don't always necessarily know what's best for us. We may ask for things that we don't really want to know. But that being said, it's so individual, and trust your gut and trust your heart, and don't do it alone. So,
other thoughts?
Well, mine's a little bit different, I guess, because I did want to know everything. When it first came out, we had two different disclosures that were 20 years apart. So the second time was when I wanted to know more, I don't know, detail? It wasn't really detailed. I just wanted to know the types of acting out that was involved. You know, I didn't need to know any of the details about it. But it was really important to have Well, he had a sponsor that he was working with. I had a sponsor that I was working with. The first time when it came out, none of that was happening, and it dribbled out, and it was so painful. It was just like I was being re-injured every time. I kept hearing a little bit more and a little bit more, you know. So the second time, even though it was so much, there was a lot more pain because the disease had progressed so much, but I had support. And he had support, and I just think that we actually ended up using in Spokane, which, by the way, I'm Crystal from Spokane. I did a polygraph because there was so much lying, and I didn't know if I wanted to be in the marriage. We were separated, and I felt like that was my only way of knowing, because we were trying to get back together, if I was really going to know who it was that I was getting back together with, you know. So it was really hard, but it wasn't as hard as the first time, I guess, you know. But that was me, and I had a lot of support. He had a lot of support. It certainly was not easy, but yeah.
Thanks, Crystal. Hi, I'm Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. So, and I'm even a little bit different on the disclosure, and I almost always have to preface with my gratitude, and I think, you know, where I come from is long-term recovery in a 12-step program, so, and living a 12-step way of life every single day, every single moment. So, I have never been like a big investigator or snooper or so I don't struggle with that. And so I think it's a combination of how the discovery of my husband's addiction came to light, which was a phone call from his sexual partner at the time. And it was kind of like a movie, like Fatal Attraction or something. And so I had an untherapeutic kind of disclosure from her. So I did ask a lot of questions of my husband, very natural, when I was just traumatized and in shock. But as I emerged from that, each day, and I've gone back and forth on this whole disclosure thing. I just knew it was right for me that I didn't need to know any more than I already knew. And I was pretty sure she told me the worst of that situation, because she was intent on destroying all of us, all three of us. So I was pretty sure I already knew the worst of that, and I knew about a couple of others, but I just, it made no difference to me. I just really consulted my heart and my higher power, and it made no difference on how I was gonna go forward to know anything more than I already knew. And sometimes in Essanon, I think that when people come to the group, they haven't been in other 12-step programs, and they're so traumatized, and so you know, they've gone to therapy, and then the therapist has recommended them to Essanon, and they think that disclosure is formal disclosure is part of the program, and it's a necessary part, and it isn't. It's a choice. And Susan one time told me, when I was early in the program, we were at the convention, and she said, it's a choice. It's for some people, and it's not for other people. And for me, I didn't think it would be helpful, so I've chosen not to. And so that's my story on disclosure.
So we'll pass it to the essays.
Who would like to go first?
You would.
I would, sure. My name's Vaughn, grateful recovering sexaholic from Surrey, British Columbia. I preface anything I have to say with the fact that these are really my opinions only from my experience, and I am one amongst many. I am no better or worse than anybody in this room. We have so much to share. Anyway, there's lots of notes up here. One actually had my name on it, so.
You wrote it.
So I wrote it. So I'll leave that. So before I read the question, I'll just give you quickly my background. My disclosure to my wife, without being in recovery, about being involved with sex trade workers, blew the marriage apart. That ties in with your disclosure. Then I was single in recovery for a while. So that leads into the question, which is, and I've been here for 25 years, plus 10 months, what is a recommended length of sobriety before a recovering sex addict begins dating again? 11 years. So I just went on the resentment list of a lot of single guys. What are clear signs that I and my sponsor need to see in my character, indicating an inward change in how I approach dating versus how I did it before? Wow, I wouldn't even call that dating what I did before, so we won't even talk about history. What I did like here was whoever wrote this mentioned about the value, obviously, of the sponsor, but and the, for me, was the value of other people in recovery. I remember I started sponsoring a couple fellows within about 4 months, which compelled me to try and stay ahead of them in the steps, because I hadn't finished the steps. And about a couple years in, I remember they were always after me, you know, you should start dating, you're a real nice guy, and that really fanned my ego. And I said, no, I'm not ready, and really I was scared to death, frankly. And then I think about a year after that, as we went through some relationship challenges, myself and the sponsees, one of them took me aside one day and said, "You're right. You are not ready for a relationship with a woman." So after I got over my resentment, I took it for what it was valued at. You know, God was saying, yeah, I'm just not ready. So over the course of the years, and by the way, I am remarried. I started dating my wife-to-be in that 11th year, proposed at the 6 months, got married 6 months later on, as my stepson suggested, 02, 02, 02, so I would remember it. So February 2nd, 2002. I met my wife in the church that I started going to within about 2 months of starting recovery. I didn't know that she, very early on, thought I was the guy that she wanted to marry. But she had to watch me for all those years. She would have preferred, frankly, that I'd asked her to date before 11 years. But in hindsight, she looks back, and knowing that I'm a sexaholic, it was really valuable for her to watch me. Because I sat about four pews from the front, nobody in front of me, because as some of you guys know, sexaholics, don't sit at the back, you'll look at who's in the crowd. So I stayed closer to the front. But over the course of being single, of course, and I never went and sat beside young ladies, but some did sit beside me. And of course, my wife-to-be apparently watched that to see, you know, just how I responded. And so I was grateful that I didn't date any of those, and I wasn't flirting or anything like that. So how did I, just very quickly, how did I get to that point of dating? I talked about it, thought about it several times. Just a bit of an aside, my first convention, I was about 6 months sober in Chicago. I went to a celibacy breakout meeting with my sponsor. I was pretty new. And there was about 30 people there, one nun, and I think about 90% were priests. And I said to my sponsor, do I have to become a priest to stay in this program single? So that, I remember that right off the bat. So to get to dating my wife, trust me, I talked with my sponsor and several other people, and they were probably a little more encouraging of me starting to date than I was. But my wife-to-be, I'd mentioned before, and we did hang out from time to time. Her son was the same age as my daughter. When my daughter would come over, frankly, I didn't know what to do with the little girl. And so, and of course, she'd go, let's go see Gail. That's my wife. Let's go see Gail and Lee. And I was like, oh, shoot. It's like, oh, great. They can look after her. But, like, I don't want to lust. And, you know, I'm not coming. So we'd go to the park or somewhere. And it'd be those three. And they're goofing off. And Vaughn's sort of walking around the outside praying. And so they were ready for this. And the people in my life said, you know, this lady's been in your life a long time. Maybe there's something to it. So finally, through certain God circumstances, I started doing some career research, asked her for her feedback on some personality stuff, and she was fairly straightforward with me about some things. And so I called her after talking to several members and a newcomer just before she came over, who was a therapist, and I asked for some insight from the newcomer, and he gave it to me right on time. My wife-to-be came over. She sat near one door. I sat near the other. I'd never asked her to come to my place. That was part of, you know, I wouldn't be around women by myself without other people. And she thought I was calling her after our recent discussion to tell her to buzz off, get out of my life, you know. That's what she thought. And instead, I said, I don't know how I came about saying, I don't remember all the words, I scared to death, that I'm a sexaholic, but I would like to pursue a relationship with you. Very romantic. Yeah. You guys taught me how to be romantic. And she was sort of dumbfounded, you know, going from thinking this is sort of the end of what she'd been hoping for to now, like, she didn't even comment on the sexaholism. She was just sort of shocked that I actually wanted to date. So that was the start. And I didn't really tell her too much about my sexaholism. I've left it wide open over the years, just so you know. And as to whether or not she wants more information, as she's actually said on a few occasions, you know, if she wanted more information, she'd ask me. Earlier on, I was sort of like, I hope she doesn't ask me. Now I think I'm, we have been married for 14 years. I think we're in this for the long haul. I think I'd be pretty comfortable that if she was going to ask me, it would be just the time that God would have me share whatever it is I need to share with her. So that's my experience with dating. Start about 11 years. Thanks.
Thanks.
So any dating?
Dating. No, I'll do another one. These are all bombs. How do you determine whether you have ADHD or just a fear of paying attention for too long? If you're an addict like me, it's pretty clear that you probably have ADHD and a whole bunch of other diagnoses which have no relevance in 12-step recovery. None. this program for me solved just about every problem that I had mentally. It just took a long, long time and a big commitment to work the steps, make a connection with my God who's driving my bus. And over the time, I started to calm down. I was thinking a few minutes ago, you know, I've always been a smart ass, but I'm so hip now I could make a living at it. I really believe my IQ's gone up about 30 points, my ability to cope with problems and not run away. And that's all God's work. God is changing my body physically. My God is changing my body physically. And that includes, you know, these outside things. And I just have to remember that I'm not in charge. And that's a tough thing because that's, you know, that's in my genetic code. And I always want to take stuff back. I always want to be big me, little you. I always want to have the answer for everybody else's problem and occasionally mine. And I just have to stay humble and in touch with the fellowship if I want to keep getting the result, which is peace and serenity. And all that other stuff just goes away. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Mike.
Try one.
Okay. Do another question.
Oh, okay. Hi, I'm still Amy. According to the program, how do you know you had a good day? For S and I. Again, grateful for the 12 steps. I was talking to my husband and I were talking to another couple at breakfast, and I actually get really incredibly sentimental when I think about, you know, 1935 and Bill and Bob and the incredible, you know, divine intervention in the 12 steps of a beautiful, beautiful blueprint for living. I usually get, I just get really sentimental about it. And as a result of my spiritual awakening, as a result of working the 12 steps, every day is a good day for me. And if there's pain in the day, it's a good day because I'm learning something. The pain is driving me deeper into relationship with my higher power and dependence on my higher power for guidance. You know, the 11th step is just my total go-to in seeking prayer and meditation, for seeking a conscious contact with God. And one of the speakers, I think it was Barry, was describing, I could be wrong, but seeking a manner of living where the 12 steps are like, the 12-step process is like brushing his teeth. Like he doesn't have to think about it. And I'm so incredibly grateful to be able to sit here and say that somewhere along the line in 29 years that happened to me. And it's an automatic thing. And I cherish every moment of every day, no matter how painful, in the moment when I, because there's a discovery to be made there, and through the prayer and meditation, I make the discoveries, and you know, it's just an automatic thing. It's like something happens, I have an emotion, and I'm just like, wow, I'm powerless over that action that person did or what they said, and if I react to that, you know, my life is unmanageable, and you know, and I'll just go through this process, a big thing or a small thing, and you know, because of the 12 steps, when the discovery happened, I was completely traumatized, completely, after 27 years of recovery, where I, for the most part, was living happy, joyous, and free. When this happened, I was in deep trouble. I was in a dark place, and I never thought that the actions of another person could do that. But you know, I love the theme of this this retreat, the humility and the grace and the hope, and because I and trust. You know, I mean, I trust the process of the 12 steps. That and that's what got me through, and it's what gets me through every single day. And so, because I'm an alcoholic, and because I had all the, you know, all the difficulties starting at a very young age, that's what brought me to the 12 steps. And I'm so grateful. I've raised three children, living a 12-step way of life. I've been sober more than half my life now. I was 29 when I got sober, and I've been in recovery for 29 years. And like I said before, it's not just about the alcohol. I learned very, very quickly, within a year, that I had, it was a symptom of a deeper issue, which is an issue I think a lot of us share. So every day is a good day when I have the 12 steps to rely on. Thanks.
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Ish. I'm a sexaholic.
I'm Ish.
And I don't know how my question got down on that end of the table. But you answered it so beautifully. Oh. Thank you so much. I was so surprised to hear that. Did you do that? All right. I wanted to say, not long ago, I read a story about a young boy who was really in a loving family, but coincidences came together, and one day his father, who had never really touched him in a mean way, lost his mind and beat him up really bad. Really bad. Bad enough that he was taken out of the home, put in child protective custody. And when I read that story, I wept. I'd been beaten up. And wow, was it hard for me to still hear that and not get really upset. Well, the story goes on where this boy's grandmother, who was the spiritual foundation really for him, you know, kept on going through over and over many times with him that there's a lesson and there's a blessing in everything that comes. And I need to keep it simple to that. I like little sound bites. Grew up on television, so that's why, I suppose. But when I'm upset, it's nice for me to as soon as possible, realize there's something in here. There's something in here. It's like a little mystery going on. I've got a feeling, and the feeling's anxious, or the feeling is anger. And if I will listen to it, pay attention, and just kind of settle in with it for a minute, where's that coming from? What's threatened here? Well, obviously, my ego is threatened pretty quickly. But if it is, if that ego is threatened, maybe I'm not really paying attention or having much of a conversation with my higher power. Because my higher power is there to really protect me and to comfort me and to really encourage me to be brave. And that's the part that I really want to be listening to. So I like that. I just like that little sound bite. You know, there's a lesson and there's a blessing. And that story goes on to where that boy, much later, grows into learning what that lesson was and really forgiving his father, realizing what pressures were on him at that time. This question I had some years of sobriety and then acted out. It's been quite a while. I'm having difficulty finding the same mindset as I had when I first came into the program. What suggestions would you have? A wonderful question. Wonderful question. Couple things come to my mind. You'll never have the same mindset as you came, as when you came in first to the program. You are very likely as open as you'll ever be to the program at the very beginning. And at first, excuse me, thank you. When you first come in, things aren't working well, but here you see people, it is working well. And you're open, and you take things in, and it seems like a honeymoon. Well, it is a honeymoon. And that's not to be discounted. Honeymoons are wonderful. Just because they don't last forever doesn't mean they're not real, and it doesn't mean they're not to be enjoyed. But it is unrealistic to think that it's going to stay forever just that way. Nothing stays just that way. And so, when it starts to fade, and it faded for me, I'd been in the program for 10 years, and I'd been sober all but one day, and lost of my sobriety. I'd been, you know, working with others. And when I took that stumble, I really lost confidence that I knew much of anything. And I said, no, I can't sponsor anymore now. I've got to figure this out. I never did figure it out. Didn't figure it out. I stumbled along for 5 years. That's a lot of stumbling. And I'd be sober for a little while, but I'd be upset, and I'd go back and act out. And, you know, when I finally realized, one of the things that I missed most was I had lost the sense of hope. That sense of, this is going to work out. And I just had so much doubt. And the doubt kept on creeping in every so often. And when I finally attached myself to somebody who I thought really epitomized hopefulness, things got turned around and I started sponsoring again. And that was a big part of why I hadn't stayed sober, because I wasn't working with other people. And I wasn't getting a sense of self-worth out of being useful, just listening to other people. Because I had to be quiet. I'm not now, am I? But so if you're having trouble, as I had trouble, I just encourage you, you just keep right after it. You go and you find people to talk to. And you find somebody who seems to have that sense of confidence and hope that their faith is working. And you keep asking questions and you be of service. And if you stopped being of service before, please pick it up again. Thank you.
I'm Crystal again. Can you give an example of how your program became about your own recovery and not fixing? Well, that's what the program's about, me. It is. I came into the program trying, so blind to living with an active sex addict, sexaholic, you know, for 30 years, you know, so I knew that I came into the program, I needed to be focusing on me. It's interesting that it says I'm not fixing, though, because I'm always trying to fix myself. Because something's so wrong with me, how did this happen? You know, so that's kind of where, you know, my story is. And, you know, I have this, I imagine, the martyr complex, you know. But, you know, the program's about not fixing anything, is surrendering to my higher power and letting my higher power fix me. Surrendering my sexaholic, you know, to my higher power to do, I'm out of that. There was a time before in recovery I would pray for him that God would, you know,
fix him, you know. you know, but it's not my job. I'm not his God, so that's my experience.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Wake him up, will you?
All right, I'll answer the one I don't want to answer. What do you think about the sobriety definition? Specifically, do you think the same-sex married couple could use SA to recover from lust? What do I think about the sobriety definition? I don't think about the sobriety definition. Absolutely not. I have an opinion on everything on this planet but that. I got enough German in me to do what works and don't mess with it. And then it says, specifically, do you think a same-sex married couple could use SA to recover from lust? Well, the third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop lusting and become sexually sober. You know, if you can get past that part, that's fine, and the rest is up to you, you know. We don't want to run anybody out of here. Period. Everybody's welcome here.
This is great. Hi, I'm Kathleen.
Hi, Kathleen.
Great for Essanon. I often hear, the question is, I often hear other SAs say, I don't want my wife to go to Essanon because it's just a bunch of clucking hens keeping tabs on their husbands and gossiping. How would you respond? Cluck, 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 cluck. You know, I think before recovery, I'd say, no, why are you afraid of this woman getting the support she might need or this partner getting? But, you know, that's none of my business. I don't know. I don't care. All I know is that all I know is what I see and experience. And over the years that I've been in recovery, the Essanons come. What do they say? They come to save the marriage, and they stay to save themselves. They stay to grow, to heal, and to become all that they can be. And I mean, I am grateful to be in Essanon because, as has already been shared, it's a wonderful way to live. It's a wonderful spiritual way to live that I wouldn't have found if my husband hadn't, you know, brought me into it in a manner of speaking. But I do grieve for the Essanons that have come and then that feel they graduated or something and have moved on. I pray for them, and I was blessed with them when they were there. But every newcomer is such a gift to our program, and there's such a, why would, you know, if the program is working for you and your program, why would you not want that for your partner? You know, why would you not want to introduce them or encourage them to finding their own way to peace and joy? So I don't know. I haven't seen any clucking hens. I will say honestly that I did come to my first meetings wondering why everybody was laughing and why people were so dang happy when this was the most miserable place place I'd ever been. And I was curious about that dichotomy, that, you know, how can they be laughing when I just want to kill myself or somebody else? And so it's just I would suggest that this individual needs to work their own program and if by their example and by their attraction of the program, their partner would be drawn to it perhaps. But anyway, that's my two cents.
Can I just say one?
Oh yeah,
sorry.
Here.
Sorry, I just have to comment on that. I've only been going, you know, for a couple of years now, but threw myself into it as I did. AA, I fell in love with AA my first meeting, and just kept coming back, and so same with Essanon. I look forward to my meetings every Tuesday night. I hear people say, "Oh, I didn't really want to come, I came anyway," and I just never feel that way. But we've had people come that have shared that at their first meeting that they came to find out what computer programs you can use, you know, how to spy on someone, or and that's what they thought, that's the kind of support they thought they were going to get, or as Deb shared, you know, I think she shared that here, maybe not, that she came to find out if anybody knew a hitman, you know. And, and how that program had worked, and so, you know, people come in, but, you know, I heard something that I agree with you. I don't pray for the people because I only pray for myself. That's all, because I really take the 11th step to heart. Pray only for knowledge of God's will for me. So, but I feel bad for them. They're missing out because a huge part of the program is giving back. Staying around. I mean, that is the. I told my ladies yesterday in the meetings, it's my greatest joy in life is to share my story and have somebody come up to me and say, "Your story gives me hope." And that's my loving my grandchildren is my second greatest joy in life. That is my first, and so they're missing out on that part. Oops, sorry.
Thanks.
Okay, me next.
Sure. Go ahead. Take it away.
I just thought this one was interesting. Would you share a funny anecdote about your step work and or recovery? I mean, funny anecdote. You know, I've struggled with my concept of God because I came into the program having a concept of God. And I have to say shim now. I can't say him, and I was always a him person. Him, God, as being male. So now, I mean, it's kind of funny. It's not like I'm being hyper feminist. I just say shim. So.
You're coming back.
And I keep coming back.
Okay. Okay, what are some concrete examples, not abstract, of how to surrender lust when it is overwhelming? I'm grateful that today that's not the situation where lust attacks are as common or as overwhelming as they used to be. But I'll tell you about in the beginning, I remember vividly when I was in my my apartment after my wife, of course, had asked me to leave. And I hadn't found the program yet, and I was laying on the bed, and there was just all kinds of images and everything going, and pain, everything was all blended together. And I remember somebody had given me some tapes of some spiritual speaker on temptation, and I had the headphones on. He was talking in my ears. I was lying on my back. I had my, you know, one of those marriage Bibles they give you. It's about 4 inches thick. I don't know if it's got more stuff in it for marriage, but, and I stuck that on my chest, and I just laid there, and I think I put one foot over on the floor, and that's how I stayed sober a few of those nights until I got to the program. Then when I got to the program, not too long after I got there, I heard one fellow share at a meeting that he probably calls 5 or 6 people a day, and I thought, boy, he's really sick. And for a guy that, you know, I was an only child, came from an alcoholic home, I learned how to survive on my own, and very successfully, except for being a sexaholic, of course. Small details. So to hear that and to find that in not too long after that, I was calling at least 5 or 6 a day, probably 3 to my sponsor and another 3 or 4 to other people, that was crucial, particularly in the heat of those temptations, whether I was at work or wherever. And That was 1990, right? I guess we didn't have cell phones then, right? Because I carried a quarter in my pocket, so did we have cell phones? Gosh, am I that old? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the good thing, by the way, the good thing about that is I'd never had problems with internet pornography because I got into recovery before then. That's not to say I haven't been tempted, trust me, but that's really a gift for me to have gotten here before that. So yeah, I carried a quarter in my pocket, went to pay phones, if that's where I had to call from, in the midst of those temptations. I shared something yesterday in a meeting that was always really helpful to me is, you know, when the temptation would come, whether it was an image or whatever, you know, of course, my internal response is, God, I don't want to lust. I don't want to lust. I don't want to treat this woman this way. And it didn't work. It was much better to go, no, I absolutely want to lust. I absolutely want to have sex. That's what I want to do, God. Now your will be done. In those moments, that's when I felt it lift. It was like all he wanted to hear me say was just be honest. You know, don't play games. Yes, a part of me does want to, but another part doesn't really want to. And certainly I did. And I worked downtown in Vancouver. So there was a number of things, just sort of boundary things around dealing with lust. To avoid it being overwhelming is I never went to lunch between lunch break, when most people do, because it's far too busy on the streets in Vancouver, and just far too much, too many images for me. So I made sure that I didn't go out during that time. I learned where to sit on the bus. And that is not at the back. I thought the back would be fine, but then I would see the women walk up the side of the bus to get on, and then I was trying to close my eyes, and eyelids would be popping open as they come down and praying that they don't sit beside me. And so I made sure that I just sat at the front. Was probably a better idea. One thing I miss, by the way, is now that cell phones are in, and you can text, is it's more common to do texting. I have to say this for my own benefit so that I'll change my behavior. I think I can rely on the text to somehow be the same as a call or getting out for a coffee or talking to somebody. In the midst of a temptation, I need another human being on the end of the phone. Yeah. It is so vital for me to call somebody. Just the example I'll give you is, and this wasn't a lust temptation, but it could have been there. My mother was visiting at Christmas time one year, and it sort of struck me, we're going to go to church on Sunday. And it struck me, go and ask your mother to go to church with you. Now, this might seem really simple to you, but to me, it was like, now, I could go out and go, hey, are you thinking of going to church today? Like that, but to go, Mom, would you go to church with me? I don't know why, it was a big deal. Anyway, so it felt like it was one of those God moments, so I walked out there in fear and trepidation and went, Mom, would you go to church with me today? No, I think I'll just stay and, you know, get ready for when you come back later. Holy cow. I can't even begin to tell you the overwhelming temptation of collapse. I mean, I just totally collapsed internally. I sort of staggered out of my apartment trying to get to the church. I stopped at a payphone with my quarter, called my sponsor. He picked up the phone and I wept. I just wept. I don't have a clue what was going on. I can still feel it today. It just touched some core stuff, and that's what I needed to do, not just in the heat of the lust. Oh, by the way, that guy who used to call 5 or 6 times a day, it wasn't because he was lusting 5 or 6. Some of it was lust, but others was the stuff underneath, and that's in the heat of the emotional moment that I have to reach out and call, because I don't want to get to the overwhelming lust. But that day, it was just, he didn't really say anything. He just listened. That's because he's half asleep, but I couldn't come up with any words to this day. I don't, you know, I just know some of the stuff that was going on, but it was just so overwhelming. And that's like, I could, and I think I skipped church because I knew wouldn't be good for me to be in the presence of people because I just wasn't doing that well. So, yeah, that's been my own experiences, connect with other people. So thanks.
I know we're just about out of time, but this question was handed over here. How can I assure that intimacy with my spouse is pure and without any component of lust or selfishness? You can't.
That's it.
That being said, don't give up on intimacy. That's what I would like to say, is that just listen to your gut. And if it doesn't feel right, you can say, you know, doesn't feel right. But I have also heard so many people just say, well, can't do it perfectly. I'm just, we're just not going to be sexual ever again. And I mean, I don't think they say that, but that's what oftentimes can happen, the fear of being hurt again, being betrayed again, having been re-traumatized by images that come up in our heads. You know what? That healing process for me and for my husband was worth going through the kind of stop starts, the kind of, well, I thought I wanted to, but it's not feeling right now. And exploring other ways to be intimate other than being sexually intimate, but developing a willingness to explore our intimacy on a brand new level. I really believe that our sexuality is a God-given gift. I mean, let's not just close the door on it. That being said, it is a process, and sometimes we need help. Therapists can be very helpful. I want to say, have fun. You know, I mean, I think that's the way that I, for my husband and I, we can get beyond, you know, is this pure, is this whatever, is this selfish? It's in, you know, make it fun and make it enjoyable and be as giving as you are in receiving. And so that's my two cents on sexuality and intimacy. I think after this is going to be our 40th year of marriage, and this is the most intimate we have ever been, and on so many different levels. It's really a joy. So.
Okay. I got a quickie here.
Sure.
What's the one thing your wife, what's the one thing your spouse would like to know about your recovery? That I'm doing the best I possibly can. That's it.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Whoops. How do you become willing to take action towards recovery? That business of willingness is a very important one, and it sometimes for me is elusive. Sometimes I get feeling I kind of understand the program pretty well, and I don't. One sign that I'm not working my program is I don't keep in touch with my sponsor. If I don't contact him fairly frequently, that's a sign I'm not too willing to take direction. I'm afraid that he's going to have a suggestion that might be a little bit scary, might be painful. I think I've been a master of avoiding that sort of thing and still be in the program. But if you're going to become willing to take action, I think it's good to be honest. Honest that you're avoiding taking direction. If a person is honest about that and honestly then begins to seek out direction and follow it, you're on the right path. Thank you.
So it's 10 o'clock, and thank you very much for letting us share.